Hey guys, my name is JD, and I want to welcome all of you back to GNG's Think Bible podcast. Now, as all of you know, we as a church family are following a reading plan that's taking us through the entire Bible in a year. And this past week, we have been reading the book of Judges. And oh, what a fascinating, honest, and at times terrible book it is. Judges covers an approximately 300-year period between Joshua's death and the Israelites asking God to give them a king. Joshua, as you remember from the book of Joshua, was Moses' right-hand man for 40 years, and he faithfully led the Israelite people into the promised land. Now, he was committed to God and to the law of Moses, and he was determined to see that the people of Israel remained faithful to their covenant with God. Now, as the book of Judges opens, we see a general snapshot of kind of where the Israelite nation is within the promised land. Judges chapter 1, verse 1 states, "Now, after the death of Joshua," so right off the bat, we know one thing. Joshua is dead, which means that they don't have a strong leader to guide them to God, because Joshua is dead, and nowhere in the book of Joshua do we see a ready successor for him, much as Moses built him up to lead the people after he was gone. We don't see that in the book of Joshua. So we don't have a strong leader guiding the people to God, but that's not all we learn. Judges chapter 2 tells us that they have failed at God's most basic instruction. Now remember, from both the book of Joshua and the book of Deuteronomy, the goal of the Israelites' conquest of the promised land was to drive out the Canaanite people living in that area. You see, the Canaanite people were so sinful and their sins so awful that God wanted to use the Israelite people as an instrument of judgment and ultimately to remove those people from the land that God had given them. But by the time we get to the book of Judges, it's become obvious that Israel hadn't done it. Sure, they moved into the land and they did in fact muscle some towns and cities out of Canaanite control, but they had absolutely not driven out their sinful neighbors. Judges chapter 2, verses 1 and 2 says that the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, so in other words, God sent an angel to tell the people, "I brought you up out of Egypt and led you to the land that I swore to give to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of this land, but shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this?" I mean, this is God talking, and you can almost kind of hear the pain in his voice. He said, "I brought you up out of Egypt. I kept my promises. I didn't break them. I won't break them, and yet you won't do what I say." In other words, God wanted the land cleared out, and he wanted the Canaanites' false and ungodly religious practices removed from the land. But because Israel didn't run them out, like a religious and moral virus, the evil beliefs and practices of the Canaanites ultimately infected the Israelite people. Judges chapter 10 to 14 says that after this whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, in other words, after the generation that kind of came into the promised land died, another generation grew up who neither knew the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. So this is a problem. In other words, the next generation clearly had not learned from their fathers and mothers how good God was and how he had brought them into the land and all the things that he had done for them. The Bible goes on to say that then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals, these false gods of the Canaanite people. They forsook the Lord, the God of their ancestors who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshiped various gods of the people around them, and they aroused the Lord's anger. I mean, think about that for a second. This group of people chosen by God to go into the land is now in really bad shape. Long story short, there is no strong spiritual leader. They've left themselves surrounded by bad company, and they begin to act like those with whom they're interacting. Just a quick side note, this is a really important truth to chew on. When you decide to walk with God, it offers you his constant love, his forgiveness, his presence in your lives. He offers you his guidance and wisdom, but it also requires something of you. It requires you to step into a different standard of living and behavior. As the old phrase goes, God loves you just as you are, but he loves you too much to leave you that way. But sometimes, when we begin the process of starting to walk with God, or we want to walk with God, we face a battle between our old life and our new life, our old ways and our new ways, and our old friends and family and the new people that God surrounds us with inside of our church family. And as I read through the book of Judges, I almost have this sense that the people of Israel are a lot like people who struggle with addiction. As many of you know, in my previous career as a mental health and addictions counselor, I spent a lot of time working with people in recovery or in active addiction. And I wish I had a dime for all the times I heard someone who was brand new to sobriety say something like, "You know what? I can handle going out to the bar with my friends. I'll just drink a Pepsi." Or, "You know what? I can spend time around those guys who smoke dope because my friends care enough about me not to use in my face." And invariably, I'd see that person later, and they would come in and tell me that they'd gotten hammered, that they drank, they picked up a new OVI charge, or they smoked something because their friends pressured them into it. As a counselor, I was constantly telling addicted people, "Listen, you have to change the people, the places, the things that are associated with your former drug use, or you'll never get out of it." And the Bible says this pretty simply in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 33. It says, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character." Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that you can't have non-Christian friends or that you can't spend time with people who don't necessarily live or believe like you. Jesus himself hung out with people that everyone thought of as the bad crowd, and probably all of us have good friends who simply don't think or do life the way that we do. I certainly do. But the ultimate question of whether or not it's a healthy friendship is this: who is influencing who? Are you the one positively influencing your peers to Christ? Or are you being influenced to move away from Christ? You see, when God commanded Israel to go into the promised land and he told them to drive out all of the other people groups in the land, he did it for a reason. You see, he knew that their character wasn't strong enough to overcome the evil behavior of the people around them. Just like the addicts I've worked with, God knew that the people of Israel couldn't withstand the moral and religious temptations they would have to face if they tried to do it on their own power. And he was right. You see, the people didn't drive out their enemies, and eventually their enemies became their examples, and the nation of Israel became no different and no better than the people God had sent them in to drive out. So that's where we are as we pick up the book of Judges. But I want to shift gears for a second, and I want to not really focus on the entire book. I want to drill down really into just one verse and one really important theme that comes out of this book. But before we dive into that fully, let me start by asking you a question. What would it be like if you were totally and completely free? I mean, free to do whatever you want. Free to live life the way that you want to. Free from any external source of rule or law. Free from anyone telling you what you can do or can't do, what you should do or shouldn't do. What would that be like? Well, on the surface, to many of us, it might even sound kind of nice. I mean, think about it. How nice would it be to wake up in the morning and not have to do anything you don't want to do? I mean, how relaxing would it be to know that if you don't like something, you just simply don't have to deal with it? What if you could drive as fast as you want, anywhere you want, all the time? What if you could walk into Walmart and grab what you want and there is no penalty if you don't pay? I mean, again, like I said, on the surface, it kind of sounds nice. Ultimate freedom, no restraints, no penalties. This is what the entire book of Judges is really all about. You see, Judges is a picture of what life is like when everyone does whatever they want. In fact, there's this really important phrase, and it's repeated on four separate occasions, right? In Judges chapter 17, verse 6, 18, verse 1, 19, verse 1, and Judges 21, 25, we read the following. It says this: "In those days, there was no king in Israel." All right? In other words, there was no central government. There was no ruling authority. The various tribes just kind of hung out in their own parts of the land, and no one was in charge. There was literally no one holding anyone accountable for following the laws that God had instituted through Moses and Joshua. But Judges 17, verse 6 and Judges 21, 25 don't just stop at telling us there was no king. It adds a following phrase that's really important. All right, it goes like this: "In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes." I'm going to read that again. "In those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes." So there wasn't a king over the land. But as we read the book of Judges, we get a really clear sense that the real problem wasn't just the lack of a king. The real problem was that everyone did whatever he or she thought was right. Now, wait a second. I mean, you may be asking, JD, did you really just say that getting to do whatever I want to do is a problem? I mean, getting to live my way, getting to live by my truth, not anybody else's truth, is a problem? Well, yes. And here's the reason. It sounds nice to us to get to do whatever we want until, of course, we have to deal with the fallout of other people doing whatever they want. You see, it's not until the unintended consequences of someone else's actions come falling down on ourselves and our families that we have a problem with it. You see, the unfortunate part of everyone doing whatever they want is that invariably we run into situations where good for me is bad for you, and vice versa. And as you look at the stories throughout the book of Judges, you see people making some really awful decisions. I mean, let's start with Gideon, right? He starts great. Like, he tears down this altar to this false god Baal. He communicates directly with the God of Israel. He saves the people from the hand of the Midianites. But then he turns around and slaughters a bunch of people, and then he creates his own god to worship. Not to mention the fact that he has a lot of wives and fathers 70-plus children. Or take his son, Abimelech, who murdered all of those brothers but one in order to be crowned the king. Or Jephthah, who won a big battle but sacrificed his own daughter because he made a stupid oath to kill the first thing that walked out of his house. I mean, sometimes I read that story and go, okay, when you're thinking that up, what do you figure is going to walk out of your house when you get home? I mean, it's craziness. Or how about Samson? Far from the stories that we were told about him as kids, Samson was a hard-drinking, womanizing murderer who did every single thing that God told him not to do. And get this, these were the people leading Israel. I mean, there's no other way to put it. When we cast off all restraints and we do whatever we want, what we end up with is not more freedom, but less. Where there are no limits, there is no freedom. I'm going to repeat that. Where there are no limits, there is no freedom. Now, this seems counterintuitive to us, right? I mean, here in America, like, the more freedom, just the more freedom, right? But not really. Let me illustrate this for you. What do we call a person who drinks alcohol to excess every single day? Right? They don't accept that there is a limit on how much they should consume. In other words, they are saying, you know what, I am free to drink as much as I want, whenever I want, however I want. What do we call this? Well, we call them an addict. And what is an addict? A person with a chemical dependency. In other words, they are physically and emotionally dependent upon that substance. In other words, they're a slave to it. Now let me ask you a question. Is a slave truly free? What about a person who is constantly seeking sexual pleasure in a way that's self-serving? Like, they refuse to accept that there should be limits on a person's sexual expression. So they may use pornography to get a sexual fix. They may use other people in large numbers, perhaps, in order to get the chance to feel good. What do we call this? Well, in our culture, we call this sexual freedom. But this person is really just a slave to sexual experiences. And again, I ask, is a slave truly free? What about the man or woman who gets so angry and lashes out or verbally or physically abuses other people? They're bent on revenge and they will have it. But when you're consumed with anger and resentment, and that's what you build your whole life around, are you really free? Simply put, the things that we so often want become the things that control us. And our freedoms often become our slave masters. So as we think about this verse, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. I think that there are a couple of really important application points with regard to this verse that we have to consider. And number one is that you and I have to recognize that left to our own desires, we will choose wrong over right. Left to our own desires, we will choose wrong over right. You see, this is what was happening all throughout the book of Judges. There was no king, there was no rule of law, and the result is a bunch of stories of people doing really horrifying things to one another, especially when you get to the end. But the temptation is for us 21st century Americans in the modern world to look back at that and go, wow, that's really horrible. We would be different. We wouldn't act like that. We would never do those awful things. But we're wrong. You see, the Bible makes it clear in Proverbs chapter 14, verse 12, that there is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Let me repeat that. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. You see, what the Bible's saying is that when you and I try to define what's good for us, apart from any external authority and apart from a concern for the desires of God and the needs of others, we will invariably choose what's wrong. This, in turn, always disappoints God and harms others. And this theme has been running throughout all the parts of the Bible that we've read so far. Let's go back to Genesis at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. God gave people the choice between letting God define good and defining good for themselves. Remember, he gave them the trees of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And he says, you can eat from the tree of life and any of the other trees that you want except this one. What's going on? He's saying, are you going to let me define what's good for you, or are you going to define what's good for yourselves? As we all know, they chose to define good for themselves. They threw off the limits that God had given them, and pardon the expression, all hell truly broke loose. You see, the reason is that you and I are masters of justifying what we do. Even when our conscience tells us that it's probably not a good thing to do, we can find ways to talk ourselves into it. That's why recognizing our tendency to choose right or to choose wrong over right is so important. You see, the point isn't to feel bad about ourselves or even beat ourselves up. The point is to be aware so that we don't trust our own thoughts and our own motives too much. Now, I can guess that maybe there are some of you listening to this for whom there's a question coming up in your mind. I mean, isn't this a really low view of humanity? I mean, come on, JD, not everyone is some horrible, awful person all the time. Right. But let me ask you a question in return. Do you lock the doors to your house when you leave? What about your car? Do you lock the doors to your office when you go home for the night? Do you hand your children to strangers? Would you leave your purse unattended in a busy restaurant? You see, at the end of the day, we all know that others can't always be trusted. And so it's only arrogance that makes us believe that we are always trustworthy. But see, this doesn't just teach us that left to our own desires, we will choose wrong over right. This verse teaches us that we need a king. We need a king. In other words, we can't be trusted to always think the right thoughts, to do the right things, or to have the right motives. So why does the author of Judges make the point of repeatedly saying that there was no king in the land? Because the land needed someone to guide it. Think about it. When a king is in place, he creates laws and rules that people are forced to obey, and the result is the culture that the king wants to see. It's no different than a boss who sets policies and procedures for his business, and he hires people who have the same values and he fires people who don't. In order for the world to work well, there has to be a leader. There has to be someone saying, this is how things work, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do. And as everyone knows, without a strong leader, businesses, sports teams, churches, and families, ultimately all of them would fail. And the problem is, as I mentioned above, there isn't one single human being on the planet qualified to be a leader on his or her own. Because at our core, we all have a tendency to do what's best for ourselves. So when we're looking for a king, we can't look to other people because those people will only let us down. But in Matthew chapter 11, verses 28 to 30, Jesus makes a really fascinating comment. He says this. He says, "Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." And when we don't really think about it, this just sounds like a really nice thing, right? Come to me, all you who are labor and heavy laden, I will give you rest, right? It's just this nice sounding thing. But think about it for a second. Jesus says in that statement that the answer to our problems, the answer to our labor and our burdenedness is his yoke. Now, those of you who are farmers probably get this, but if you're not, maybe you don't. But the idea of a yoke is that it attaches two animals together to a plow or to a wagon, and it helps them work together. But it also limits where the animal can go. Think about it. When two animals are yoked together, they can only go one direction. Their options are limited. Now, one might be stronger than the other and pull it a little bit this or that, but they both have to go the same direction. And what Jesus is saying is that his yoke, his direction, his way is the real way to freedom. In other words, when you eliminate all the options and you just go with what Jesus says, he says that's the real way to freedom. And this seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? I mean, he says, "Come to me, all you who are laboring and burdened, and I'll put a yoke on you." I mean, it totally strikes us as a contradiction. But what he's saying is that restraint is freedom. Being yoked lets us be free in ways that having no restraints ever could. Because our freedom so often leads us into slavery. When you and I do whatever we want to do, and we do it regardless of what anybody else thinks, we often end up enslaved to something. And what Jesus says is that the best thing for us is to be under his yoke, to be under his guidance and direction. When Jesus said, "Come to me, all you who are laboring and heavy laden," it seems pretty obvious that what he's referring to is the weight and pressure of trying to determine good for ourselves. He's saying, in effect, just let me lead you. And let me guide you, and you'll experience a freedom that you could never have by trying to do life your own way. Guys, simply put, we need a king. And Jesus, through his sacrificial death on the cross, has offered to be our king. And his word, the Bible, is the yoke that guides us and shows us how to live the way he tells us to. But, much like the book of Judges, the choice is ultimately ours. Do we want him? Will we accept his yoke? Will we stop trying to do life our way and choose what he calls right? Will we be willing to let him define what is good rather than deciding what's good in our own eyes? You see, our answers to those questions will decide whether or not we go through life with the light and easy yoke of Christ, or if we choose to live out our own personal version of the book of Judges. Either way, the choice is up to us. Well, guys, that's all the time we have today. I love you all, and until next time, think biblically, think logically, and think honestly.